beside him. If he moved back a bit, he could see the top branches of the orange trees just over the wall. Again he closed his eyes. The scents of the garden descended upon him, their contours as precise and clear as the coloured bands of a rainbow. And that one, that precious one, that one that mattered above all else, was among them. Grenouille turned hot with rapture and cold with fear. Blood rushed to his head, as if he were a little boy caught red-handed, and then it retreated to his solar plexus, and then rushed up again and retreated again, and he could do nothing to stop it. This attack of scent had come on too suddenly. For a moment, for a breath, for an eternity, it seemed to him, time was doubled or had disappeared completely, for he no longer knew whether now was now and here was here, whether now was not in fact then and here there, that is, the Rue des Marais in Paris, September 1753. The scent floating out of the garden was the scent of the red-headed girl he had murdered that night. To have found that scent in this world once again brought tears of bliss to his eyes, and to know that it could not possibly be true frightened him to death. He was dizzy. He tottered a little and had to support himself against the wall, sinking slowly down against it in a crouch. Collecting himself and gaining control of his senses, he began to inhale the fatal scent in short, less dangerous breaths. And he established that, while the scent from behind the wall bore an extreme resemblance to the scent of the red-headed girl, it was not completely the same. To be sure, it also came from a red-headed girl, there was no doubt of that. In his olfactory imagination, Grenouille saw this girl as if in a picture. She was not sitting still, she was jumping about, warming up and then cooling off, apparently playing some game in which he had to move quickly and then just as quickly stand still, with a second person, by the way, someone with a totally insignificant odour. She had dazzlingly white skin, she had green eyes, she had freckles on her face, neck and breasts, that is, and Grenouille's breath stopped for a moment, then he sniffed more vigorously and tried to suppress the memory of the scent of the girl from the Rue des Marais. That is, this girl did not even have breasts in the true sense of the word. She barely had the rudimentary start of breasts. Infinitely tender, and with hardly any fragrance, sprinkled with freckles, just beginning to expand, perhaps only in the last few days, perhaps in the last few hours, perhaps only just at this moment, such were the little cupped breasts of this girl. In a word, the girl was still a child. But what a child! The sweat stood out on Grenouille's forehead. He knew that children did not have an exceptional scent, any more than green buds of flowers before they blossom. This child behind the wall, however, this bud, still almost closed tight, which only just now was sending out its first fragrant tips, unnoticed by anyone except by him, Grenouille, this child already had a scent so terrifyingly celestial that once it had unfolded its total glory, it would unleash a perfume such as the world had never smelled before. She already smells better now, Grenouille thought, than that girl did back then in the Rue des Marais. Not as robust, not as voluminous, but more refined, more richly nuanced, and at the same time more natural. In a year or two, this scent will be ripened and take on a gravity that no one, man or woman, will be able to escape. People will be overwhelmed, disarmed, helpless before the magic of this girl, and they will not know why. And because people are stupid and use their noses only for blowing, but believe absolutely anything they see with their eyes, they will say it is because this is a girl with beauty and grace and charm. In their obtuseness, they will praise the evenness of her features, her slender figure, her faultless breasts, and her eyes, they will say, are like emeralds, and her teeth like pearls, and her limbs smooth as ivory, and all those other idiotic comparisons. And they will elect her queen of the jasmine, and she will be painted by stupid portraitists, her picture will be ogled, and people will say that she is the most beautiful woman in France. And to the strains of mandolins, Youths will howl the nights away, sitting beneath her window. Rich, fat old men will skid about on their knees, begging her father for her hand. And women of every age will sigh at the sight of her, and in their sleep dream of looking as alluring as she for just one day. And none of them will know that it is truly not how she looks that has captured them, not her reputed unblemished external beauty, but solely her incomparable, splendid scent. Only he would know that, only Grenouille, he alone. He knew it already, in fact. Ah, he wanted to have that scent, not in the useless, clumsy fashion by which he had had the scent of the girl in the Rue des Marais, for he had merely sucked that into himself and destroyed it in the process. No, he wanted truly to possess the scent of this girl behind the wall, to peel it from her like skin, and to make her scent his own. But how that was to be done, he did not know yet. But he had 2 years in which to learn. Ultimately, it ought to be no more difficult than robbing a rare flower of its perfume. He stood up, almost reverently, as if leaving behind something sacred or someone in deep sleep. He moved on softly, hunched over, so that no one might see him, no one might hear him, no one might be made aware of his precious discovery. And so he fled along the wall to the opposite end of the town, where he finally lost the girl's scent and re-entered by way of the Porte des Fainéants. He stood in the shadow of the buildings. The stinking vapours of the streets made him feel secure and helped him to tame the passions that had overcome him. Within 15 minutes he had grown perfectly calm again. To start with, he thought, he would not again approach the vicinity of the garden behind the wall. That was not necessary. It excited him too much. The flower would flourish there without his aid, and he knew already in what manner it would flourish. He dared not intoxicate himself with that scent prematurely. He had to throw himself into his work. He had to broaden his knowledge and perfect the techniques of his craft in order to be equipped for the time of harvest. He had a good 2 years. 36. Not far from the Porte des Fainéants, in the Rue de la Louve, Grenouille discovered a small perfumer's workshop and asked for a job. It turned out that the proprietor, Maître Parfumeur Honoré Arnulfi, had died the winter before, and that his widow, a lively, black-haired woman of perhaps 30, was managing the business alone, with the help of a journeyman. After complaining at length about the bad times and her own precarious financial situation, Madame Arnulfi declared that she really could not afford a second journeyman, but on the other hand she needed one for all the upcoming work, that she could not possibly put up a second journeyman here in the house, but on the other hand she did have at her disposal a small cabin in an olive grove behind the Franciscan cloister, not 10 minutes away, in which a young man of modest needs could sleep in a pinch. Further, that as an honest mistress she certainly knew that she was responsible for the physical well-being of her journeymen, but that on the other hand she did not see herself in a position to provide 2 warm meals a day. In short, as Grenouille had of course smelled for some time already, Madame Arnulfi was a woman of solid prosperity and sound business sense. And since he was not concerned about money, and declared himself satisfied with a salary of 2 francs a week and with the other niggardly provisions, they quickly came to an agreement. The first journeyman was called in, a giant of a man named Drouot. Grenouille at once guessed that he regularly shared Madame's bed, and that she apparently did not make certain decisions without first consulting him. With legs spread wide and exuding a cloud of spermy odour, he planted himself before Grenouille, who looked ridiculously frail in the presence of this Hun, and inspected him, looked him straight in the eye, as if this technique would allow him to recognise any improper intentions or a possible rival, finally grinned patronisingly and signalled his agreement with a nod. That settled it. Grenouille got a handshake, a cold evening snack, a blanket and a key to the cabin, a windowless shack that smelled pleasantly of old sheep dung and hay, where he made himself at home as well as he could. The next day he began work for Madame Arnulfi. It was jonquil season. Madame Arnulfi had the flowers grown on small parcels of land that she owned in the broad basin below the city, or she bought them from farmers, with whom she haggled fiercely over every ounce. The blossoms were delivered very early in the morning, emptied out in the workshop by the basketfuls into massive but lightweight and fragrant piles. Meanwhile, in a large cauldron, Drouot melted pork lard and beef tallow to make a creamy soup into which he pitched shovelfuls of fresh blossoms, while Grenouille constantly had to stir it all with a spatula as long as a broom. They lay on the surface for a moment, like eyes facing instant death, and lost all colour the moment the spatula pushed them down into the warm, oily embrace. And at almost the same moment they wilted and withered, and death apparently came so rapidly upon them that they had no choice but to exhale their last fragrant sighs into the very medium that drowned them. For, and Grenouille observed this with indescribable fascination, the more blossoms he stirred under into the cauldron, the sweeter the scent of the oil. And it was not that the dead blossoms continued to give off scent there in the oil. No, the oil itself had appropriated the scent of the blossoms. Now and then the soup got too thick, and they had to pour it quickly through a sieve, freeing it of macerated cadavers to make room for fresh blossoms. Then they dumped and mixed and sieved some more, all day long without pause, for the procedure allowed no delays, until, as evening approached, all the piles of blossoms had passed through the cauldron of oil. Then, so that nothing might be wasted, the refuse was steeped in boiling water and wrung out to the last drop in a screw press, yielding still more mildly fragrant oil. The majority of the scent, however, the soul of the sea of blossoms, had remained in the cauldron, trapped and preserved in an unsightly, slowly congealing, greyish-white grease. The following day, the maceration, as this procedure was called, continued. The cauldron was heated once again, the oil melted and fed with new blossoms. This went on for several days, from morning till evening. It was tiring work. Grenouille had arms of lead, calluses on his hands, and pains in his back as he staggered back to his cabin in the evening. Although Drouot was at least three times as strong as he did not once take a turn at the stirring, but was quite content to pour in more feather-like blossoms to tend the fire, and now and then, because of the heat, to go out for a drink. But Grenouille did not mutiny. He stirred the blossoms into the oil without complaint, from morning till night, and hardly noticed the exertion of stirring, for he was continually fascinated by the process taking place before his eyes and under his nose, the sudden withering of the blossoms and the absorption of their scent. After a while, Drouot would decide that the oil was finally saturated and could absorb no more scent. He would extinguish the fire, sieve the viscous soup one last time, and pour it into stoneware crocks, where almost immediately it solidified to a wonderfully fragrant pomade. This was the moment for Madame Arnulfi, who came to assay the precious product, to label it and to record in her books the exact quality and quantity of the yield. After she had personally capped the crocks, had sealed them and borne them to the cool depths of her cellar, she donned her black dress, took out her widow's veil, and made the rounds of the city's wholesalers and vendors of perfume. In touching phrases she described to these gentlemen her situation as a woman left all on her own, let them make their offers, compared the prices, sighed, and finally sold, or did not sell. Perfumed pomades, when stored in a cool place, keep for a long time. And when the price leaves something to be desired, who knows, perhaps it will climb again come winter or next spring. Also you had to consider whether instead of selling to these hucksters, you ought not to join with other small producers, and together ship a load of pomade to Genoa, or share in a convoy to the autumn fair in Beaucaire. Risky enterprises, to be sure, but extremely profitable when successful. Madame Arnulfi carefully weighed these various possibilities against one another, and sometimes she would indeed sign a contract, selling a portion of her treasure, but hold another portion of it in reserve, and risk negotiating for a third part all on her own. But if, during her inquiries, she had got the impression that there was a glut on the pomade market, and that in the foreseeable future there would be no scarcity to her advantage, she would hurry back home, her veil wafting behind her, and give Drouot instructions to subject the whole yield to a lavage and transform it into an essence absolue. And the pomade would be brought up again from the cellar, carefully warmed in tightly covered pots, diluted with rectified spirits, and thoroughly blended and washed with the help of a built-in stirring apparatus that Grenouille operated. Returned to the cellar, this mixture quickly cooled. The alcohol separated from the congealed oil of the pomade and could be drained off into a bottle. A kind of perfume had been produced, but one of enormous intensity, while the pomade that was left behind had lost most of its fragrance. Thus the fragrance of the blossoms had been transferred to yet another medium. But the operation was still not at an end. After carefully filtering the perfumed alcohol through gauze that retained the least little clump of oil, Drouot filled a small alembic and distilled it slowly over a minimum flame. What remained in the mattress was a tiny quantity of a pale-hued liquid that Grenouille knew quite well, but had never smelled in such quality and purity, either at Baldini's or Runel's. The finest oil of the blossom, its polished scent concentrated 100 times over to a little puddle of essence absolue. This essence no longer had a sweet fragrance. Its smell was almost painfully intense, pungent and acrid. And yet, one single drop, when dissolved in a quart of alcohol, sufficed to revitalize it and resurrect a whole field of flowers. The yield was frightfully small. The liquid from the mattress filled 3 little flacons, no more. Nothing was left from the scent of hundreds of thousands of blossoms except those 3 flacons. But they were worth a fortune, even here in Grasse, and worth how much more once delivered to Paris or Lyon, to Grenoble, Genoa, or Marseille. Madame Arnulfi's glance was suffused with beauty when she looked at the little bottles. She caressed them with her eyes, and when she picked them up and stoppered them with snugly fitting glass stoppers, she held her breath to prevent even the least bit of the precious contents from being blown away. And to make sure that after stoppering not the tiniest atom would evaporate and escape, she sealed them with wax and encapsulated them in a fish bladder tightly tied around the neck of the bottle. Then she placed them in a crate stuffed with wadded cotton and put them under lock and key in the cellar. 37. In April they macerated broom and orange blossoms. In May, a sea of roses, the scent from which submerged the city in a creamy, sweet, invisible fog for a whole month. Grenouille worked like a horse. Self-effacing and as acquiescent as a slave, he did every menial chore Drouot assigned him. But all the while he stirred, spatulated, washed out tubs, cleaned the workshop, or lugged firewood with apparent mindlessness, nothing of the essential business, nothing of the metamorphosis of scent escaped his notice. Grenouille used his nose to observe and monitor more closely than Drouot ever could have the migration of scent of the flower petals, through the oil and then via alcohol to the precious little flacons. Long before Drouot noticed it, he would smell when the oil was overheated, smell when the blossoms were exhausted, when the broth was impregnated with scent. He could smell what was happening in the interior of the mixing pots, and the precise moment when the distilling had to be stopped. And occasionally he let this be known, of course quite unassumingly and without abandoning his submissive demeanour. It seemed to him, he said, that the oil might possibly be getting too hot. He almost thought that they could filter shortly. He somehow had the feeling that the alcohol in the alembic had evaporated now. And in time, Drouot, who was not fabulously intelligent, but not a complete idiot either, came to realize that his decisions turned out for the best when he did, or ordered to be done, whatever Grenouille almost thought or somehow had a feeling about. And since Grenouille was never cocky or know-it-all when he said what he thought or felt, and because he never, particularly never in the presence of Madame Arnulfi, cast Drouot's authority and superior position of first journeyman in doubt, not even ironically, Drouot saw no reason not to follow Grenouille's advice, or, as time went on, not to leave more and more decisions entirely to his discretion. It was increasingly the case that Grenouille did not just do the stirring, but also the feeding, the heating, and the sieving, while Drouot stepped round to the Quatre Dauphins for a glass of wine, or went upstairs to check out how things were doing with Madame. He knew that he could depend on Grenouille. And although it meant twice the work, Grenouille enjoyed being alone, perfecting himself in these new arts, and trying an occasional experiment. And with malicious delight, he discovered that the pomades he made were incomparably finer, that his essence absolue was several percent purer than those that he produced together with Drouot. Jasmine season began at the end of July. August was for tuberoses. The perfume of these two flowers was both so exquisite and so fragile that not only did the blossoms have to be picked before sunrise, but they also demanded the most gentle and special handling. Warmth diminished their scent. Suddenly to plunge them into hot, macerating oil would have completely destroyed it. The souls of these noblest of blossoms could not be simply ripped from them. They had to be methodically coaxed away. In a special impregnating room, the flowers were strewn on glass plates smeared with cool oil, or wrapped in oil-soaked cloths. There they would die slowly in their sleep. It took 3 or 4 days for them to wither and exhale their scent into the adhering oil. Then they were carefully plucked off, and new blossoms spread out. This procedure was repeated a good 10, 20 times, and it was September before the pomade had drunk its fill and the fragrant oil could be pressed from the cloths. The yield was considerably less than with maceration, but in purity and verisimilitude the quality of the jasmine paste or the huile antique de tubéreuse won by such a cold enfleurage exceeded that of any other product of the perfumer's art. Particularly with jasmine, it seemed as if the oiled surface were a mirror image that radiated the sticky-sweet, erotic scent of the blossom with lifelike fidelity, cum grano salis, of course. For Grenouille's nose obviously recognised the difference between the odour of the blossoms and their preserved scent. The specific odour of the oil, no matter how pure, lay like a gossamer veil over the fragrant tableau of the original, softening it, gently diluting its bravado, and perhaps only then making its beauty bearable for normal people. But in any case, cold enfleurage was the most refined and effective method to capture delicate scents. There was no better. And even if the method was not good enough completely to satisfy Grenouille's nose, he knew quite well that it would suffice 1,000 times over for duping a world of numbed noses. Just as with maceration, after only a brief time he had likewise surpassed his tutor Drouot in the art of cold perfumery, and had made this clear to him in the approved, discreet, and grovelling fashion. Drouot gladly left it to him to go to the slaughterhouse and buy the most suitable fats, to purify and render them, to filter them and adjust their proportions, a terribly difficult task that Drouot himself was always skittish about performing, since an adulterated or rancid fat, or one that smelled too much of pig, sheep or cow, could ruin the most expensive pomade. He let Grenouille decide how to arrange the oiled plates in the impregnating room, when to rotate the blossoms, and whether the pomade was sufficiently impregnated. Drouot soon let Grenouille make all the delicate decisions that he, just as Baldini before him, could only approximate with rules of thumb, but which Grenouille made by employing the wisdom of his nose, something Drouot, of course, did not suspect.
"He's got a fine touch," said Drouot. "He's got a good feel for things."
And sometimes, he also thought, "really and truly, he is more talented than me, 100 times a better perfumer." And all the while he considered him to be a total nitwit, because Grenouille, or so he believed, did not cash in at all on his talent, whereas he, Drouot, even with his more modest gifts, would soon become a master perfumer. And Grenouille encouraged him in this opinion, displaying doltish drudgery and not a hint of ambition, acting as if he comprehended nothing of his own genius and were merely executing the orders of the more experienced Drouot, without whom he would be a cipher. After their fashion, they got along quite well. Then came autumn and winter. Things were quieter in the workshop. The floral scents lay captive in their crocks and flacons in the cellar, and if Madame did not wish some pomade or other to be washed, or for a sack of dried spices to be distilled, there was not all that much to do. There were still the olives, a couple of basketfuls every week. They pressed the virgin oil from them and put what was left through the oil mill, and wine, some of which Grenouille distilled to rectified spirit. Drouot made himself more and more scarce. He did his duty in Madame's bed, and when he did appear, stinking of sweat and semen, it was only to head off at once for the Quatre Dauphins. Nor did Madame come downstairs often. She was busy with her investments, and with converting her wardrobe for the period that would follow her year of mourning. For days, Grenouille might often see no one except the maid who fixed his midday soup and his evening bread and olives. He hardly went out at all. He took part in corporate life, in the regular meetings and processions of the journeymen, only just often enough as to be conspicuous neither by his absence nor by his presence. He had no friends or close acquaintances, but took careful pains not to be considered arrogant or a misfit. He left it to the other journeymen to find his society dull and unprofitable. He was a master in the art of spreading boredom and playing the clumsy fool, though never so egregiously that people might enjoy making fun of him or use him as the butt of some crude practical joke inside the guild. He succeeded in being considered totally uninteresting. People left him alone, and that was all he wanted. 38. He spent his time in the workshop. He explained to Drouot that he was trying to invent a formula for a new cologne. In reality, however, he was experimenting with scents of a very different sort. Although he had used it very sparingly, the perfume that he had mixed in Montpellier was slowly running out. He created a new one, but this time he was not content simply to imitate basic human odour by hastily tossing together some ingredients. He made it a matter of pride to acquire a personal odour, or better yet, a number of personal odours. First he made an odour for inconspicuousness, a mousy workaday outfit of odours with the sour, cheesy smell of humankind still present, but only as if exuded into the outside world through a layer of linen and wool garments covering an old man's dry skin. Bearing this smell, he could move easily among people. The perfume was robust enough to establish the olfactory existence of a human being, but at the same time so discreet that it bothered no one. Using it, Grenouille was not actually present, and yet his presence was justified in the most modest sort of way— a bastard state that was very handy, both in the Arnulfi household and on his occasional outings in the town. On certain occasions, to be sure, this modest scent proved inconvenient. When he had errands to run for Drouot, or wanted to buy his own civet or a few musk pods from a merchant, he might prove to be so perfectly inconspicuous that he was either ignored and no one waited on him, or was given the wrong item or forgotten while being waited on. For such occasions he had blended a somewhat more redolent, slightly sweaty perfume, one with a few olfactory edges and hooks that lent him a coarser appearance and made people believe he was in a hurry and on urgent business. He also had good success with a deceptive imitation of Drouot's Aura Seminalis, which he learnt to produce by impregnating a piece of oily linen with a paste of fresh duck eggs and fermented wheat flour, and used whenever he needed to arouse a certain amount of notice. Another perfume in his arsenal was a scent for arousing sympathy that proved effective with middle-aged and elderly women. It smelled of watery milk and fresh, soft wood. The effect Grenouille created with it, even when he went out unshaved, scowling and wrapped in a heavy coat, was of a poor, pale lad in a frayed jacket who simply had to be helped. Once they caught a whiff of him, the market women filled his pockets with nuts and dried pears, because he seemed to them so hungry and helpless. And the butcher's wife, an implacably callous old hag, if ever there was one, let him pick out for free smelly old scraps of meat and bone, for his odour of innocence touched her mother's heart. He then took these scraps, digested them directly in alcohol, and used them as the main component for an odour that he applied when he wanted to be avoided and left completely alone. It surrounded him with a slightly nauseating aura, like the rancid breath of an old slattern's mouth when she awakens. It was so effective that even Drouot, hardly a squeamish sort, would automatically turn aside and go in search of fresh air, without any clear knowledge, of course, of what had actually driven him away. And sprinkling a few drops of the repellent on the threshold of his cabin was enough to keep every intruder, human or animal, at a distance. Protected by these various odours, which he changed like clothes as the situation demanded, and which permitted him to move undisturbed in the world of men and to keep his true nature from them, Grenouille devoted himself to his real passion, the subtle pursuit of scent. And because he had a great goal right under his nose, and over a year still left to him, he not only went about the task with burning zeal, but he also systematically planned how to sharpen his weapons, polish his techniques, and gradually perfect his methods. He began where he had left off at Baldini's, with extracting the scent from inert objects. Stone, metal, glass, wood, salt, water, air. What before had failed so miserably using the crude process of distillation succeeded now, thanks to the strong absorptive powers of oil. Grenouille took a brass doorknob, whose cool, musty, brawny smell he liked, and wrapped it in beef tallow for a few days, and sure enough, when he peeled off the tallow and examined it, it smelled quite clearly like the doorknob, though very faintly. And even after a lavage in alcohol, the odour was still there, infinitely delicate, distant, overshadowed by the vapour of the spirits, and in this world probably perceptible only to Grenouille's nose, but it was certainly there. And that meant, in principle at least, at his disposal. If he had 10,000 doorknobs, and wrapped them in tallow for 1,000 days, he could produce a tiny drop of brass doorknob essence absolue, strong enough for anyone to have the indisputable illusion of the original under his nose. He likewise succeeded with the porous chalky dust from a stone he found in the olive grove before his cabin. He macerated it and extracted a dollop of stone pomade, whose infinitesimal odour gave him indescribable delight. He combined it with other odours taken from all kinds of objects lying around his cabin, and painstakingly reproduced a miniature olfactory model of the olive grove behind the Franciscan cloister. Carrying it about with him, bottled up in a tiny flacon, he could resurrect the grove whenever he felt like it. These were virtuoso odours, executed as wonderful little trifles that, of course, no one but he could admire or would ever take note of. He was enchanted by their meaningless perfection. And at no time in his life, either before or after, were there moments of such truly innocent happiness as in those days when he playfully and eagerly set about creating fragrant landscapes, still lifes, and studies of individual objects. For he soon moved on to living subjects. He hunted for winter flies, for maggots, rats, small cats, and drowned them in warm oil. At night he crept into stalls to drape cows, goats, and piglets for a few hours in cloths smeared with oil, or to wrap them in greasy bandages. Or he sneaked into sheepfolds and stealthily sheared a lamb, and then washed the redolent wool in rectified spirit. At first the results were not very satisfactory, for in contrast to the patient things, doorknobs and stones, animals yielded up their odour only under protest. The pigs scraped off the bandages by rubbing against the posts of their styes. The sheep bleated when he approached them by night with a knife. The cows obstinately shook the greasy cloths from their udders. Some of the beetles that he caught gave off foully stinking secretions while he was trying to work with them, and the rats, probably out of fear, would shit in the olfactorily sensitive pomades. Unlike flowers, the animals he tried to macerate would not yield up their scent without complaints or with only a mute sigh. They fought desperately against death, absolutely did not want to be stirred under, but kicked and struggled, and in their fear of death created large quantities of sweat whose acidity ruined the warm oil. You could not, of course, do sound work under such conditions. The objects would have to be quieted down, and so suddenly that they would have no time to become afraid or to resist. He would have to kill them. He first tried it with a puppy. He enticed it away from its mother with a piece of meat, all the way from the slaughterhouse to the laboratory, and as the animal panted excitedly and lunged joyfully for the meat in Grenouille's left hand, he gave one quick hard blow to the back of its head with a piece of wood he held in his right. Death descended on the puppy so suddenly that the expression of happiness was still on its mouth and in its eyes, long after Grenouille had bedded it down in the impregnating room on a grate between two greased plates, where it exuded its pure doggy scent, unadulterated by the sweat of fear. To be sure, one had to be careful. Carcasses, just as plucked blossoms, spoiled quickly. And so Grenouille stood guard over his victim for about 12 hours, until he noticed that the first wisps of carrion scent, not really unpleasant, but adulterating, nevertheless, rose up from the dog's body. He stopped the enfleurage at once, got rid of the carcass, and put the impregnated oil in a pot, where he carefully rinsed it. He distilled the alcohol down to about a thimbleful, and filled a tiny glass tube with these few remaining drops. The perfume smelled clearly of dog. Moist, fresh, tallowy, and a bit pungent, it smelled amazingly like dog. And when Grenouille let the old bitch at the slaughterhouse sniff at it, she broke out in yelps of joy, and whimpered, and would not take her nose out of the glass tube. Grenouille closed it up tight, and put it in his pocket, and bore it with him for a long time, as a souvenir of his day of triumph, when, for the first time, he had succeeded in robbing a living creature of its aromatic soul. Then, very gradually, and with utmost caution, he went to work on human beings. At first he stalked them from a safe distance with a wide-meshed net, for he was less concerned with bagging large game than with testing his hunting methods. Disguised by his faint perfume for inconspicuousness, he mingled with the evening's guests at the Quatre Dauphins Inn, and stuck tiny scraps of cloth drenched in oil and grease under the benches and tables and in hidden nooks. A few days later he collected them and put them to the test, and indeed, along with all sorts of kitchen odours, tobacco smoke and wine smells, they exhaled a little human odour. But it remained very vague and masked, was more the suggestion of general exhalations than a personal odour. A similar mass aura, though purer and more sublimely sweaty, could be gleaned from the cathedral, where, on December the 24th, Grenouille hung his experimental flags under the pews and gathered them in again on the 26th, after no less than 7 masses had been sat through just above them. A ghastly conglomerate of odour was reproduced on the impregnated swatches. Anal sweat, menstrual blood, moist hollows of knees and clenched hands, mixed with the exhaled breath of thousands of hymn-singing and Ave Maria-mumbling throats, and the oppressive fumes of incense and myrrh. A horrible concentration of nebulous, amorphous, nauseating odours, and yet unmistakably human. Grenouille garnered his first individual odour in the Hôpital de la Charité. He managed to pilfer sheets that were supposed to be burned, because the journeyman sackmaker who had lain wrapped in them for 2 months had just died of consumption. The cloth was so drenched in the exudations of the sackmaker that it had absorbed them like an enfleurage paste and could be directly subjected to lavage. The result was eerie. Right under Grenouille's nose, the sackmaker rose olfactorily from the dead, ascending from the alcohol solution, hovering there, the phantom slightly distorted by the peculiar methods of reproduction and the countless miasmas of his disease, but perfectly recognisable in space as an olfactory personage. A small man of about 30, blonde, with a bulbous nose, short limbs, flat, cheesy feet, swollen genitalia, choleric temperament, and a stale mouth odour. Not a handsome man, aromatically speaking, this sackmaker, not worth being held on to for any length of time, like the puppy. And yet, for one whole night, Grenouille let the scent spectre flutter about his cabin, while he sniffed at him again and again, happy and deeply satisfied with the sense of power that he had won over the aura of another human being. He poured it out the next day. He tried one more experiment during these winter days. He discovered a deaf-mute beggar woman wandering through the town, and paid her 1 franc to wear several different sets of rags smeared with oils and fats against her naked skin. It turned out that lamb suet, pork lard, and beef tallow, rendered many times over, combined in a ratio of 2 to 5 to 3, with the addition of a small amount of virgin oil, was best for absorbing human odour. Gurnui let it go at that. He refrained from overpowering some whole live person and processing him or her perfumatorily. That sort of thing would have meant risks and would have resulted in no new knowledge. He knew he now was master of the techniques needed to rob a human of his or her scent, and he knew it was unnecessary to prove this fact anew. Indeed, human odour was of no importance to him whatever. He could imitate human odour quite well enough with surrogates. What he coveted was the odour of certain human beings, that is, those rare humans who inspire love. These were his victims. 39. In January, the widow Arnulfi married her first journeyman, Dominique Drouot, who was thus promoted to maître gantier et parfumeur. There was a great banquet for the guildmasters, and a more modest one for the journeymen. Madame bought a new mattress for her bed, which she now shared officially with Drouot, and took her gay finery from the armoire. Otherwise, everything remained as it was. She retained the fine old name of Arnulfi, and retained her fortune for herself, as well as the management of the finances and the keys to the cellar. Drouot fulfilled his sexual duties daily, and refreshed himself afterwards with wine. And although he was now the one and only journeyman, Grenouille took care of most of the work at hand in return for the same small salary, frugal board, and cramped quarters. The year began with a yellow flood of cassias, then hyacinths, violet petals, and narcotic narcissus. One Sunday in March, it was about a year now since his arrival in Grasse, Grenouille set out to see how things stood in the garden behind the wall at the other end of town. He was ready for the scent this time, knew more or less exactly what awaited him, and nevertheless, as he caught a whiff of it at the Pot Neuve, no more than halfway to the spot beside the wall, his heart beat more loudly, and he felt the blood in his veins tingle with pleasure. She was still there, the incomparably beautiful flower. She had survived the winter unblemished. Her sap was running. She was growing, expanding, driving forth the most exquisite ranks of buds. Her scent had grown stronger, just as he had expected, without losing any of its delicacy. What a year before had been sprinkled and dappled about was now blended into a faint, smooth stream of scent that shimmered with 1,000 colours, and yet bound each colour to it and did not break. And this stream, Grenouille recognised blissfully, was fed by a spring that grew ever fuller. Another year, just 1 more year, just 12 more months, and that spring would gush over, and he could come to cap it and imprison the wild flow of its scent. He walked along the wall to the spot behind which he knew the garden was located. Although the girl was apparently not in the garden, but in the house, in her room behind closed windows, her scent floated down to him like a steady, gentle breeze. Grenouille stood quite still. He was not intoxicated or dizzy, as he had been the first time he had smelled it. He was filled with the happiness of a lover who has heard or seen his darling from afar, and knows that he will bring her home within the year. It was really true. Grenouille, the solitary tick, the abomination, Grenouille the monster, who had never felt love and would never be able to inspire it, stood there beside the city wall of Grasse on that day in March, and loved, and was profoundly happy in his love. True, he did not love another human being, certainly not the girl who lived in the house beyond the wall. He loved her scent. That alone, nothing else, and only inasmuch as it would one day be his alone. He would bring it home within the year, he swore it by his very life. And after this strange oath, or betrothal, this promise of loyalty given to himself and to his future scent, he left the place light of heart and returned to town through the Port du Cour. That night, as he lay in his cabin, he conjured up the memory of the scent, He could not resist the temptation, and immersed himself in it, caressed it, and let it caress him, so near to it, as fabulously close as if he possessed it already in reality, his scent, his own scent. And he made love to it, and to himself through it, for an intoxicatingly, deliciously long time. He wanted this self-loved feeling to accompany him in his sleep. But at the very instant when he closed his eyes, in the moment of the single breath it takes to fall asleep, it deserted him, was suddenly gone, and in its place the room was filled with the cold, acrid smell of goat's stall. Grenouille was terrified. What happens, he thought, if the scent, once I possess it? What happens if it runs out? It's not the same as it is in your memory, where all scents are indestructible. The real thing gets used up in this world. It's transient. And by the time it has been used up, the source I took it from will no longer exist. And I will be as naked as before, and will have to get along with surrogates, just like before. No, it will be even worse than before. For in the meantime, I will have known it and possessed it, my own splendid scent, and I will not be able to forget it, because I never forget a scent. And for the rest of my life I will feed on it in my memory, just as I was feeding right now from the premonition of what I will possess. What do I need it for at all? This was a most unpleasant thought for Grenouille. It frightened him beyond measure to think that once he did possess the scent that he did not yet possess, he must inevitably lose it. How long could he keep it? A few days? A few weeks? Perhaps a whole month, if he perfumed himself very sparingly with it. And then? He saw himself shaking the last drops from the bottle, rinsing the flacon with alcohol so that the last little bit would not be lost. And then he saw, smelled, how his beloved scent would vanish in the air, irrevocably, forever. It would be like a long, slow death, a kind of suffocation in reverse, an agonizing, gradual self-evaporation into the wretched world. He felt chilled. He was overcome with a desire to abandon his plans, to walk out into the night and disappear. He would wander across the snow-covered mountains, not pausing to rest, hundreds of miles into the Auvergne, and there creep into his old cave, and fall asleep and die. But he did not do it. He sat there, and did not yield to his desire, although it was strong. He did not yield, because that desire was an old one of his, to run away and hide in a cave. He knew about that already. What he did not yet know was what it was like to possess a human scent as splendid as the scent of the girl behind the wall. And even knowing that to possess that scent he must pay the terrible price of losing it again, the very possession and the loss seemed to him more desirable than a prosaic renunciation of both. For he had renounced things all his life, but never once had he possessed and lost. Gradually the doubts receded, and with them the chill. He sensed how the warmth of his blood revitalized him, and how the will to do what he had intended to do again took possession of him. Even more powerfully than before, in fact, for that will no longer originated from simple lust, but equally from a well-considered decision. Grenouille the Tick presented the choice between drying up inside himself or letting himself drop, had decided for the latter, knowing full well that this drop would be his last. He lay back on his makeshift bed, cosy in his straw, cosy under his blanket, and thought himself very heroic. Grenouille would not have been Grenouille, however, if he had long been content with the fatalist's heroic feelings. His will to survive and conquer was too tough, his nature too cunning, his spirit too crafty for that. Fine. He had decided to possess the scent of the girl behind the wall. And if he lost it again after a few weeks and died of the loss, that was fine too. But better yet would be not to die and still possess the scent, or at least to delay its loss as long as humanly possible. One simply had to preserve it better. One must subdue its evanescence without robbing it of its character, a problem of the perfumer's art. There are scents that linger for decades. A cupboard rubbed with musk, a piece of leather drenched with cinnamon oil, a glob of ambergris, a cedar chest. They all possess virtually eternal olfactory life. While other things, lime oil, bergamot, jonquil and tuberose extracts, and many floral scents, evaporate within a few hours if they are exposed to the air in a pure, unbound form. The perfumer counteracts this fatal circumstance by binding scents that are too volatile, by putting them in chains, so to speak, taming their urge for freedom, though his art consists of leaving enough slack in the chains for the odour seemingly to preserve its freedom, even when it is tied so deftly that it cannot flee. Grenouille had once succeeded in performing this feat perfectly with some tuberose oil, whose ephemeral scent he had chained with tiny quantities of civet, vanilla, labdanum, and cypress. Only then did it truly come into its own. Why should not something similar be possible with the scent of this girl? Why should he have to use, to waste, this most precious and fragile of all scents in pure form? How crude! How extraordinarily unsophisticated! Did one leave diamonds uncut? Did one wear golden nuggets around one's neck? Was he, Grenouille, a primitive pillager of scents like Drouot or these other macerators, distillers and blossom-crushers? Or was he not rather the greatest perfumer in the world? He banged his fist against his brow. To think he had not realized this before. But of course this unique scent could not be used in a raw state. He must set it like the most precious gemstone. He must design a diadem of scent, and at its sublime acme, intertwined with the other scents and yet ruling over them, his scent would gleam. He would make a perfume using all the precepts of the art, and the scent of the girl behind the wall would be the very soul of it. As the adjuvants, as bass, tenor and soprano, as zenith and as fixative, musk and civet, attar of roses or neroli were inappropriate, that was certain. For such a perfume, for a human perfume, he had need of other ingredients. 40. In May of that same year, the naked body of a 15-year-old girl was found in a rose field, halfway between Grasse and the hamlet of Oppio, east of town. She had been killed by a heavy blow to the back of the head. The farmer who discovered her was so disconcerted by the gruesome sight that he almost ended up a suspect himself, when, in a quivering voice, he told the police lieutenant that he had never seen anything so beautiful, when he had really wanted to say that he had never seen anything so awful. She was indeed a girl of exquisite beauty. She was one of those languid women made of dark honey, smooth and sweet and terribly sticky, who take control of a room with a syrupy gesture, a toss of the hair, a single slow whiplash of the eyes, and all the while remain as still as the centre of a hurricane, apparently unaware of the force of gravity by which they irresistibly attract to themselves the yearnings and the souls of both men and women. And she was young, so very young that the flow of her allure had not yet grown viscous. Her full limbs were still smooth and solid, her breasts plump and pert as hard-boiled eggs, and the planes of her face, brushed by her heavy black hair, still had the most delicate contours and secret places. Her hair, however, was gone. The murderer had cut it off and taken it with him, along with her clothes. People suspected the gypsies. Gypsies were capable of anything. Gypsies were known to weave carpets out of old clothes, and to stuff their pillows with human hair, and to make dolls out of the skin and teeth of the hanged. Only gypsies could be involved in such a perverse crime. There were, however, no gypsies around at the time, not a one, near or far. Gypsies had last come through the area in December. For lack of gypsies, people decided to suspect the Italian migrant workers. But there weren't any Italians around either. It was too early in the year for them. They would first arrive in the region in June, at the time of the jasmine harvest, so it could not have been the Italians either. Finally, the wig makers came under suspicion, and they were searched for the hair of the murdered girl. To no avail. Then it was the Jews who were suspect. Then the monks of the Benedictine cloister, reputedly a lecherous lot, although all of them were well over 70. Then the Cistercians, then the Freemasons, then the lunatics from the Charité, then the charcoal burners, then the beggars, and last but not least, the nobility, in particular the Marquis of Cabris, for he had already been married 3 times, and organised, so it was said, orgiastic black masses in his cellars, where he drank the blood of virgins to increase his potency. Of course, nothing definite could be proved. No one had witnessed the murder. The clothes and hair of the dead woman were not found. After several weeks, the police lieutenant halted his investigation. In mid-June, the Italians arrived, many with families, to hire themselves out as pickers. The farmers put them to work as usual, but with murder still on their minds, forbade their wives and daughters to have anything to do with them. You couldn't be too cautious. For although the migrant workers were in fact not responsible for the actual murder, they could have been responsible for it on principle, and so it was better to be on one's guard. Not long after the beginning of the jasmine harvest, 2 more murders occurred. Again, the victims were very lovely young girls, again of the languid, raven-haired sort. Again, they were found naked and shorn, and lying in a flower field, with the backs of their heads bludgeoned. Again, there was no trace of the perpetrator. The news spread like wildfire, and there was a threat that hostile action might be taken against the migrants, when it was learned that both victims were Italians, the daughters of a Genoese day-labourer. And now fear spread over the countryside. People no longer knew against whom to direct their impotent rage. Although there were still those who suspected the lunatics or the cryptic Marquis, no one really believed that, for the former were under guard day and night, and the latter had long since departed for Paris. So people huddled closer together. The farmers opened up their barns for the migrants, who until then had slept in the open fields. The townsfolk set up nightly patrols in every neighbourhood. The police lieutenant reinforced the watch at the gates. But all these measures proved useless. A few days after the double murder, they found the body of yet another girl, abused in the same manner as the others. This time it was a Sardinian washerwoman from the bishop's palace. She had been struck down near the great basin of the Fontaine de la Foux, directly before the gates of the town. And although at the insistence of the citizenry the consuls initiated still further measures, the tightest possible control at the gates, a reinforced night watch, a curfew for all female persons after nightfall, all that summer not a single week went by when the body of a young girl was not discovered. And they were always girls just approaching womanhood, and always very beautiful, and usually dark, sugary types. Soon, however, the murderer was no longer rejecting the type of girl more common among the local population, soft, pale-skinned, and somewhat more full-bodied. Even brown-haired girls and some dark blondes, as long as they weren't too skinny, were among the later victims. He tracked them down everywhere, not just in the open country around Grasse, but in the town itself, right in their homes. The daughter of a carpenter was found slain in her own room on the 5th floor, and no one in the house had heard the least noise, and although the dogs normally yelped the moment they picked up the scent of any stranger, not one of them had barked. The murderer seemed impalpable, incorporeal, like a ghost. People were outraged and reviled the authorities. The least rumour caused mob scenes. A travelling salesman of love potions and other nostrums was almost massacred, for word spread that one of the ingredients in his remedies was female hair. Fires were set at both the Cabris mansion and the Hôpital de la Charité. A servant returning home one night was shot down by his own master, the woolen draper Alexandre Misnard, who mistook him for the infamous murderer of young girls. Whoever could afford it sent his adolescent daughters to distant relatives or to boarding schools in Nice, Aix or Marseille. The police lieutenant was removed from office at the insistence of the town council. His successor had the College of Medicine examine the bodies of the shorn beauties to determine their state of virginity. It was found that they had all remained untouched. Strangely enough, this knowledge only increased the sense of horror, for everyone had secretly assumed that the girls had been ravished. People had at least known the murderer's motive. Now they knew nothing at all. They were totally perplexed. And whoever believed in God sought succour in the prayer that at least his own house should be spared this visitation from hell. The town council was a committee of 30 of the richest and most influential commoners and nobles in Gass.